national news from a grassroots perspective. You're listening to Grand Wire, community radio news from coast to coast to coast. This edition is hosted by Ophira Horowitz
and by Aji D. Leafy on unceded Algonquin Territory in Ottawa.
And by Jesse Wins on Attawandaron Territory in Guelph, Ontario. Audio production was done by Tom Radford.
Today, on a special year-end episode, we will be looking back on some of the most impactful stories of 2014, including the federal government's prostitution bill, C-36, pipelines and oil sands, and missing and murdered Indigenous women.
Sex workers don't feel comfortable approaching the police and having the violence against them taken seriously.
A reactive approach, which is unfortunately what the national inquiry is, but a proactive approach.
People do not want these pipelines. They do not want Canada to keep pushing this old system of fossil fuels. They want to change to renewable energy.
And now here's our feature story on Bill C-36. When the Supreme Court struck down Canada's prostitution laws in December of 2013 after years of pressure, the Conservative government was given 1 year to amend the legislation. During this time of uncertainty, sex workers and their allies intensified the conversation around the necessary rights and protections of people in the sex trade, hoping that the new legislation would respond to the concerns of sex workers and not just the concerns of the greater community. On June 4, 2014, Bill C-36 was tabled, which is otherwise known as the Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act. On the June 9th episode of Groundwire, Rachel Swadek of CFUV let us in on the outrage and resistance of sex workers and their allies in response to Bill C-36, just days after its release.
Canadian sex trade workers and advocates are speaking out against a tough new prostitution bill. Sex workers could face jail time for selling sexual services anywhere children under 18 years old may be present. Emily Simons is the chair of POWER, Prostitutes of Ottawa, Gatineau, Work, Educate, and Resist.
And we know that sex workers who are working on the streets protect themselves in three key ways. They protect themselves by taking the time to screen a client and looking at a bad date list before jumping into a vehicle. They work in groups or in pairs where they can take down license plates and watch out for each other. Mm-hmm. And they work in well-lit and well-populated areas where if they scream, someone will hear them. So we already have laws to protect sex workers. We have laws against physical assault, against sexual assault, against underage prostitution, against human trafficking. And problem is that sex workers don't feel comfortable approaching the police and having the violence against them taken seriously.
Organizations that advocate for the safety and human rights of sex workers exist all across Canada in cities like Montreal, Ottawa, Toronto, and Vancouver. They provide supplies such as condoms and hygiene products, safer drug use kits, workshops, housing resources, referrals to sex work positive accountants and lawyers, and more. Some organizations are even made up entirely of lawyers and other legal experts, such as Pivot Legal Society, who seek to assist sex workers in Vancouver's Lower East Side navigate the legal system and resist criminalization. These organizations are often the first to address important changes in the Canadian legislation regarding sex work. Through direct involvement and relationships with their communities and by performing critical research, these organizations respond both reactively and proactively to the ever-changing social and political climate, influencing how sex workers do their business and why they make the choices that they do. Despite such organizations being at the forefront of sex workers' rights issues in Canada, their voices are often minimized in the mainstream media. Their work is sensationalized to promote anti-sex work sentiments, and they lack proportional and accurate representation during government hearings. On the June 23rd edition of Groundwire, Amelie Philipson of CKUT in Toronto conducted a series of interviews with sex work advocacy organizations across Canada.
The federal government has tabled its new prostitution legislation. According to Robin Maynard from sex work advocacy group Stella, the new legislation is bringing back many of the same laws, but under different wording, which is concerning for sex workers.
Is the difference between exploitative ways in which somebody can be gaining from a sex worker's money or somebody that she might be paying to work with her in terms of, say, other workers or somebody who helps her screen her clients. And though they're saying that this wouldn't target those people, it's very unclear in the legislation whether or not that's actually true.
According to Joyce Arthur from advocacy group First Decriminalize Sex Work in Vancouver, Creating more dangerous working conditions for sex workers makes Bill C-36 unconstitutional.
The Charter of Rights and Freedoms protects people's right to life, liberty, security of the person, freedom of expression, and equality. So arguably all of these are breached by Bill C-36. They're recriminalizing third party relationships, and sex workers, you know, don't always want to work alone. They often want to work with others. These people can help keep sex workers safe.
An article on CatholicRegister.org states that MP Joy Smith, who prepared the ground for the bill supporting the abolition of prostitution, said, "Prostitution exploits women, youth, and vulnerable populations." Mrs. Scream from sex work advocacy group Big Susie's says that this isn't true.
Most people in the sex industry are doing it out of their own free will. And sometimes people are doing it out of financial desperation, but that's the job that they choose to do to be able to make the money.
That was Emily Phillipson of CKUT in Montreal interviewing Robin Maynard of Stella, Joyce Arthur of First Decriminalized Sex Work in Vancouver, and Ms. Scream of Big Susie's in Hamilton, three Canadian sex work advocacy organizations. Though organizations like Power, Stella, First, and Big Susie's decry Bill C-36 as being a danger to the people in the sex trade, this isn't the case for all organizations that provide services to vulnerable people. According to the following piece, most sexual assault centers in Canada support Bill C-36, but there are exceptions that we must pay close attention to. After Justice Committee hearings at the House of Commons ceased in July, Megan Thomas of CJSF in Burnaby spoke to Rachel Phillips, the Executive Director of Peers Resource Society in Victoria, for the September 1st episode of Groundwire.
On August 25, 2014, the Victoria Sexual Assault Centre issued a statement of support for the Senate submission of Peers Victoria Resource Centre on Bill 36, the Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act. Peers' Senate submission speaks against the criminalization of the adult sex work industry and against Bill C-36. Rachel Phillips, Executive Director of Peers, speaks to the significance of this support by the Victoria Sexual Assault Centre.
Yeah, we were really excited and heartened, actually, because, as you've noted, there is this division among organizations, women-serving organizations, for one, and then sexual assault centers and persons representing organizations that deal with sexual violence. Victoria Sexual Assault Center is our local sexual assault center, and so we just felt really grateful that they showed some solidarity with peers and that they're taking a stance as a sexual assault center in support of sex workers' rights. This is the first I've heard of it. That's not to say that there aren't other examples.
That was Megan Thomas of CJSF in Burnaby speaking to Rachel Phillips, the Executive Director of Peers Resource Society in Victoria, BC. Next up, just what is human trafficking? Layla Lamgala reported to us from CKUT in Montreal on September 15th, shortly after the September 9th Senate committee hearings, where additional witnesses gathered to discuss the subject matter of Bill C-36. By this point in the process, there remained less than 4 months for the Conservative government to finalize the proposed new legislation. Layla spoke to Valerie Scott of the Sex Professionals of Canada and to Naomi Sayers, an Indigenous law student and former sex worker.
One of the salient debates at the heart of Bill C-36 is that while the bill is known as the Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act, it would also make prostitution between adults illegal. Valerie Scott is legal coordinator for the network Sex Professionals of Canada. Speaking to Senate last week, she pointed out that there are already laws on the books to go after the sex industry's violent criminals.
I think an important thing for your listeners to know is that what is human trafficking. Most people think of that as someone forcing a person, moving them from location to location. The prohibitionists, the religious groups who intervened in our case, and they have changed the definition of human trafficking, although they didn't bother to tell the press this. It isn't moving a person or forcing a person. They consider anyone in sex work to be humanly trafficked.
Naomi Sayers is founder of Southwestern Ontario Sex Workers, and she is currently a common law student at the University of Ottawa.
When we criminalize something, we also add stigma to that act. We really need to diversify the discussion here, because sex workers, just like the general population, they come from diverse backgrounds, diverse experiences. People, they just don't know. And we have to, you know, use this as an opportunity to educate, and people have to be willing to learn.
On December 6, 2014, despite 4 months of hard work and resistance, Bill C-36 was passed into law. On the December 22nd edition of Groundwire, Carly Forbes of CILU in Toronto updated us on the organized resistance that took place following this devastating event.
December 17th marked the International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers. From coast to coast, sex workers and their allies gathered in protest of Bill C-36. And also to honor the lives of people working in the sex trade who have been lost. In Toronto, at Queen's Park, sex workers and allies called on Premier Wynne to abstain from enforcing Bill C-36, which went into effect on December 6. Premier Wynne has tasked Ontario's Attorney General to determine the constitutionality of the laws, but she also stated that Ontario will be following the laws as they are written. In St. John's, Newfoundland, a red umbrella protest was organized in support of the rights of sex workers. In November, the Safe Harbor Outreach Project Coordinator, Laura Winters, wrote an open letter to Premier Davis to refer the new laws to the Court of Appeals to determine their constitutionality before enforcing the laws. In her letter, Laura Winters stated, quote, "Sadly, this legislative response runs counter to the spirit and letter of the Supreme Court of Canada's decision and will replicate the harms of the previous laws, which were found to be unconstitutional."
2015 will undoubtedly mark another year that sex workers and their allies fight back against the criminalization of sex work and continue to push for new laws that will serve the best interest of sex workers in Canada. This has been Jessie Wins reporting for Groundwire, CFRU, Guelph, Ontario. Up next is Groundwire's review of oil pipeline coverage in 2014.
In the past year, the Canadian public has become increasingly concerned with pipelines that carry a very heavy type of oil called bitumen, which is extracted from the earth in Alberta. Bitumen is a type of very heavy oil. It's so thick and viscous that it needs to be diluted from its raw form with a lighter oil before it's thin enough to flow through a pipeline. Alberta has the third largest deposit of oil in the world, after Saudi Arabia and Venezuela. This resource is landlocked. So before it can be profitable, the producers need a method of transporting it to refineries and markets around the world. That's where the pipelines come in. Supporters say that pipelines are the most economical and least carbon-intensive way to transport oil, spilling less oil on average than any other method. And they're popular. According to the Canadian Energy Pipeline Association, there are about 830,000 kilometers of pipeline crisscrossing the country. And currently most of our transportation infrastructures run on oil and oil byproducts. That being said, pipelines have met an enormous amount of resistance in recent years. In 2014, Groundwire covered protests against Energy East, Northern Gateway, Trans Mountain, and Line 9 pipelines. Many people have questions about what would happen if a pipeline bursts or springs a leak, which could lead to lots of oil being spilled in a short amount of time, and who would be left with the consequences of a major inland oil spill. Indigenous filmmaker Crystal Green, interviewed by Michael Welch in Winnipeg in April of 2014, asked herself similar questions after she attended two open houses hosted by the TransCanada Corporation to acquaint the public with the Energy East pipeline project. The TransCanada Corporation has to get the approval of the National Energy Board before they can proceed with the project. As part of their application, they need to consult with people whose daily lives and quality of life will be affected by the pipeline's construction and by risks associated with the chances of an accident. Ms. Green, however, came away from the open houses feeling like it was a very artificial process and that she was spoken at rather than heard.
My name is Crystal Green. I live in Winnipeg, and my family comes from Shoal Lake, which is just east of Winnipeg, and it's where Winnipeg gets its drinking water from. Okay, well, I've been to two open houses. The problem with these open houses is that, like, when you're looking around at all the other people in the room who are there to ask questions and talk with the TransCanada reps, you don't exactly get to hear what the other people are saying. So you're stuck one-on-one with a TransCanada representative, and I feel that it's kind of, it kind of alienates oneself from other people who are there with the same concerns. Like, it's a very controlled setting where they're guiding and they're kind of, you know, telling you what you want, like what they think you want to hear. And it just, every time I asked a question, like they wouldn't give me a straight answer.
The following exchange between TransCanada representative Philippe Canon and a member of the public was recorded by Crystal at the March 18th consultation in Winnipeg.
Last year, this year, we've invested $1 billion in our safety infrastructure program, but only for pipelines. So we take this very, very seriously. It's something that we do, and we don't cut corners on security.
So how does it work? Where does it go if there's a leak?
Actually stay in the pipeline depending on the type of field we're looking at, depending on where the pump station is, depending on if where, because you're saying it's a pipe rupture and everything would flow out. It doesn't work like that.
I felt that he was downplaying the potential for spills, and I also felt he was downplaying the risks to people along the pipeline route in the event of a spill. He wasn't able to answer the question that I asked, which was what happens in the event of a spill. He was almost suggesting that the oil would stay in the pipeline. That's never happened before. I don't know why it would happen in this event.
In Winnipeg, from the heart of occupied Anishinaabe Aking, homeland of the Métis and traditional territory of the Niiwok and the Nakota, this is CKW's Michael Welch. For Groundwire.
While the building of pipelines to carry oil is an environmental issue, many see it also as a colonial issue. Pipelines are permanent infrastructure that cross through unceded land and can pose a threat to the traditional way of living of local Indigenous people. The protesters that we interviewed on Groundwire in 2014 took issue that the pipelines cross land with non-settled claims. Recently, on December 14th, a coalition of students, families, and environmental organizations marched to the residence of Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne to protest the Energy East pipeline. The following audio is from the archives of the Toronto Media Co-op.
You flip-flop and you flip-flop. People in Grassy Narrows, they know what you're all about. We know what you're all about. So we're here to sing the treaty song for you to remind you of your obligations to First Nations people.
Protesters not only rallied against pipelines, but against the oil industry as a whole. Many people expressed their frustration with society's continued reliance on oil, despite the evidence that significant climate damage may result from years of oil use and production. Journalists from CJSF at Simon Fraser University spoke with Stephen Collis, a professor who is against the Trans Mountain Pipeline on Burnaby Mountain, about how he believes that as a society, we're not letting pipeline construction go forward, because we don't believe that our government is representing our best long-term interests. This clip was recorded by Jay Peachy for his show Wild Salmon Warrior Radio on CJSF.
People are, you know, galvanized by this. People do not want these pipelines. They do not want Canada to keep pushing this old system of fossil fuels. They want to change to renewable energy. They're getting the message that's everywhere on this planet right now, and everyone is speaking this talk increasingly. Even, you know, institutions like the IMF, which is not exactly a radical institution, instructing governments just to start disinvesting from fossil fuels. We have to do this. So people realize that and see this as a fight that they want to get behind.
In the next year, we'll be following the ongoing controversy surrounding some of these projects as they move from getting approved to getting built. This is Ophira Horowitz reporting for Groundwire. Up next, we review Groundwire's 2014 coverage of missing and murdered Indigenous women.
Last May, the RCMP issued a report that recorded 1,181 cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women between 1980 and 2012 in Canada, which roughly represents 16% of all homicides of women and 10% of all cases of missing women in Canada. In other words, Indigenous women are about 5 times more likely to be murdered than non-Indigenous women, and yet they account for less than 5% of the overall Canadian population of women.
On August 21, 2014, Prime Minister Stephen Harper gave a speech at Yukon College in Whitehorse in which he stated, "I think we should not view this as a sociological phenomenon. We should view it as a crime." The Prime Minister was responding to a question about the renewed calls for a federal inquiry in the wake of the death of the 15-year-old Tina Fontaine in Winnipeg. He added that crime has already been studied extensively, so there is no need for further inquiry. Despite the evidence that Indigenous women are overrepresented in the Canadian statistics for missing and murdered women, it appears that the federal government is doing little to address the problem. Due to this perceived inaction, many Canadians took matters into their own hands this year and staged many vigils, blockades, and marches to raise awareness for missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, and some launched their own initiatives to publish independent reports and action plans. The Feminist Alliance for International Action, or FAFIA, is a Canadian group that works at the international level to improve conditions for women in Canada. On December 1, 2014, they launched a campaign to raise awareness of two forthcoming reports focused on Canada's missing and murdered Indigenous women. Megan Murphy interviewed Cherry Smiley and Sheila Day, who are activists with FAFIA. Megan Murphy produces the podcast Feminist Current.
The RCMP finally undertook its own study, and after years of their disputing the numbers that the Native Women's Association of Canada was collecting through the Sisters in Spirit project, the RCMP numbers turned out to be much higher than NWAC's, as NWAC had in fact predicted, because they said, "We believe that we have an undercount." There has to be a recognition that we have a systemic problem on our hands. This is the reason, I think, why everyone reacted to Stephen Harper's comment about it's not a social phenomenon, it's a crime. The call for a national public inquiry, which is now so widespread, comes out of frustration because Aboriginal women, advocacy groups, the Native Women's Association of Canada started 10 years ago saying at that time, look, we have this systemic problem on our hands. Let's have a national action plan.
It's so important, as Sheila was saying, that we need perpetrators held accountable. And this goes for, you know, violence against women across the board. It's abysmal, the response that we get, but particularly so for Aboriginal women and girls, and then also looking at mental health and drug and alcohol addiction, all those other things that the government can be putting money into, you know, help Aboriginal women and girls be less vulnerable to violence. But we need to really make sure that Aboriginal women and girls have access to our languages and our cultures. And some of the time, the violence that we're facing is coming from the men in our own communities. So it becomes very difficult then to have access to our languages and cultures if we're living in, you know, a constant state of fear.
The National Aboriginal Women's Summit took place at the end of October last year. At the summit, plans for a roundtable discussion on missing and murdered Indigenous women were discussed by representatives of every province and territory, alongside leaders of the five national Indigenous organizations. The roundtable will take place in Yellowknife in 2015. We spoke with Dr. Dawn Harvard, the Vice President of the Native Women's Association of Canada, who helped organize the summit.
So one of the most important things that we had coming out of this particular summit that we have not had in the past is we had the commitment from every one of the provinces and territories in Canada. We had political representatives from each province and territory come to the summit. They sat around the table with us, and each province, each territory gave their commitment. They put their support behind the need for the national inquiry, behind the need for a national roundtable so that we are having not always a reactive approach, which is unfortunately what the national inquiry is. You know, it's trying to understand the problem after the fact, but a proactive approach as well, which is hopefully what the national roundtable will be.
Every year on October 4th, the association Sisters in Spirit organizes vigils across Canada to honor the lives of missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls and to support their grieving families. This year, Jesse Wins brought us this report from Guelph, Ontario.
Hey!
Last week, as part of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women campaign, Sisters in Spirit organizations across the country held vigils for missing and murdered Indigenous women across Canada. At Marianne's Park in Guelph, Ontario, dozens gathered in a closed circle to join a group of Indigenous mothers, elders, and community organizers in honoring the lost lives of our Indigenous sisters. A placard resembling a missing person poster that asks, "Am I next?" was available for people to write down their name and have their photo taken, an acknowledgement of the fact that Indigenous women continue to be missing and murdered at increasing rates in Canada. Kelly Grace, an Indigenous woman who works for Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis, introduced the participants to the vigil.
Tonight, we have decided to hold a candlelight vigil, one that is more intimate, one that honors our missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls, and supports their grieving families. There's a great strength in unity. Tonight, we are united for a common cause and drawing the attention to the Canadian human rights tragedy. Tonight and together, we must demand action.
This has been Jesse Winokur from CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, reporting for Groundwire.
Walking with Our Sisters is an art installation and a memorial that honors the lives of missing and murdered Indigenous women. The exhibition has toured for a little over a year and will travel across the country for the next 7 years. Groundwire covered Walking with Our Sisters as it passed through Thunder Bay in September and again in November as Ottawa held a community conversation to prepare to receive the exhibition in 2015. Ophira Horwitz prepared this report about Walking with Our Sisters coming to Ottawa and spoke with Christy Belcourt, the artist who began Walking with Our Sisters.
How is Walking with Our Sisters different than what we usually think of as an art exhibition?
So Walking with Our Sisters is an art installation, but it's more than that. It's a memorial. We say that it's a memorial because there's a lot of ceremony and community organization involved in it, and the main goal of it is to honor the lives of our missing and murdered Indigenous sisters. What a person would see when they walk in there is they would see the floor covered entirely in red cloth. And on top of that red cloth, there are moccasin vamps. Now, vamps are the tops of moccasins. Sometimes they're called uppers. And they're the part that is typically adorned with beadwork or quillwork or some other kind of decoration on the top. So the vamps are intentionally not sewn into the moccasins to represent the unfinished lives of murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls.
The murder and disappearance of Indigenous women and girls is a national problem, and it needs to be addressed as soon as possible. This is Audrey D. Luffy reporting from Ottawa for Groundwire. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, hosted by Jesse Wins, Ophira Horwitz, and Audrey D. Luffy.
The stories that we featured on the show today were collected over the course of the year. The stories about Bill C-36 were by Rachel Swadek, Emily Phillipson, Megan Thomas, Leila Lemgalef, and Carly Forbes.
Stories about pipelines were by Michael Welch, Nikki Young, and Jay Peachy.
And the stories about missing and murdered Indigenous women were by Megan Murphy, Ophira Horwitz, and Jesse Wins.
We also thank Tom Radford for his production work, Ed Von Attercast, Jason Armstrong, and Jay Jackson for their feedback, the Groundwire Steering Committee for their ongoing guidance and support, and everybody who contributed stories to Groundwire in 2014.